All right, if you've been in our Sunday morning class, we've been talking about the Pharisees. The reason for that was we have an important Pharisee in Acts chapter 5, a fellow by the name of Gamaliel. And you may remember that in our last class, we talked about the fact that there were seven different types of Pharisees. At least that's the best historical information that we have. Not quite sure where Gamaliel came in as far as that list, but we do know that he was well-regarded, highly regarded by the people in that day and time. We've left off with Acts chapter 5, verse 36, and that's where we want to begin today. This is in the context of Gamaliel giving a defense, not because he is really supportive of the apostles, but he wants to calm things down. The Sanhedrin, the people who had gathered with them, were very, very upset. They wanted to kill the apostles. He's trying to pour some cold water on their ire, their temper, their anger. And in Acts 5:36, the text says, "For before these days, up Thutis, giving himself out to be somebody, to whom a number of men, about 400, joined themselves, who was slain in all, and as many as obeyed him were dispersed and came to naught." Now, this is part of Gamaliel's presentation to, as I said, to calm things down a little bit. So he's urging caution. You can see that back in verse 35 based on not only this event, but another event or two as well. He says, before these days, think back. There is some historical information here that you need to consider. There was, in his mind, a situation which was similar. Now, that's not really true, but sometimes the facts don't matter when people are this upset. So he goes back and pulls from history and tries to make a parallel. He says there is this fellow by the name of Thutis, and he says he was somebody. Now, as you look at that word, what would come to mind if you were trying to study this out on your own? He claimed to be somebody. All right, we would at least want to say that. Somebody who is noteworthy. Would you like to go a little bit further and talk about why he was noteworthy? Now think about who we're talking about here. Jews or Gentiles? Well, possibly that. Jews or Gentiles? Well, possibly that. But Jews or Gentiles? Who we're talking about here? Jews. Right. I knew if I persisted enough we were going to get an answer to that question. So, very good. All right, Jews. And if you were a Jew, who would have really mattered to you out of all the people that could have shown up?
The Messiah.
All right, the Messiah. So if you're going to call yourself somebody, chances are it would have been along what lines? You might have claimed authority and you might have claimed power and all these other things, but more than likely you are also going to be making some messianic claims. And that would be somewhat parallel to the apostles. Not that they were making messianic claims, but they were claiming to serve the Messiah. So, reading between the lines a little bit, I think that's what he was doing. He was claiming to be the Messiah, or is claiming to be great in some other way, some kind of deliverer. And the Bible says he rose up. We'll come back to you in a second, Bonnie. He rose up. Once again, if you were looking at this in your home, on your own, how would you understand that? He got out of bed one morning, he rose up. Well, he stood up, all right. Not that he got out of bed, but... All right, an insurrection. He was trying to lead people in some type of revolt. Bonnie, you had a thought?
The King James Version says boasting himself to be somebody. Isn't that what he was doing?
Okay, if you're going to claim to be the Messiah, you would make that boast, you would make that claim, and then try to form your own little group and start your own little revolution.
Well, how do you get that he was claiming to be the Messiah?
I think if you look at who we're dealing with, the Jews... Who would they have been most inclined to follow?
To looking for the Messiah?
Yeah, looking for the Messiah.
Okay.
So I think, especially when you're looking at the time period here, that would make sense. Again, it doesn't say that he was the Messiah, but remember John the Baptist? Jews came to him and said, what? Are you the Messiah, or should we look for somebody else? And this is who they were looking for. So it would fit in with the context of the overall message of the New Testament. Carolyn, then we'll take Stan's hand. Sure. Yeah. Now, they don't all, some do, but they don't all get a following. But you have sometimes people that do some crazy things. Sometimes they'll take a weapon and do some bad things. Sometimes they'll be out there in the street corner. Other times they're a very charismatic kind of individual, and they will actually be able to collect a follower, and they turn perhaps that group into a cult, that kind of thing. So, yes, nothing has really changed. But our culture is a little less charged for a Messiah than the Jews. I mean, they were primed. They were looking for that. Stan.
Well,
That's true. They were looking for a Messiah. But when we were talking about Jesus and when he came on the scene, they were looking for, even in Jesus, they were looking for somebody to overthrow the Romans, a more secular king, per se. And this period of time we're talking about is right on the heels of the Maccabean Wars. So it appears to me, without knowing, I guess I'm showing my ignorance here, but these could have very well been people who rose up against the Romans. And the Jews would have considered someone like that a quote-unquote Messiah.
Absolutely. Yeah, they weren't looking so much for a spiritual deliverer. They were looking to get rid of the Roman yoke.
Right.
And if somebody came along and said, hey, yes, we're here to, we're God's servant, to get rid of the Romans for you, that would have been very, very appealing to at least some. Anybody else? Okay, a couple other quick points here. When you have that word which is translated rose up, once again, if you're looking at that on your own, do you think you might wonder a little bit? Huh, rose up, or maybe similar wording. That sounds a little bit like Jesus, resurrection. And it is the same word. So I don't know that there's a play on words here, but that's really interesting that he rose up, Jesus also rose up. So as you look at Gamaliel's argument, Acts 5 verse 36, at this point you have what has sometimes been referred to as a proverb or a good saying, give a man enough rope and what's he going to do? He is going to hang himself. And that's really Gamaliel's argument. That's what happened with this guy. He rose up. There were some people with him. He failed. Now you give Jesus' followers enough rope. They're also going to fail. We've seen this before. As you look at Thutis, some people have gone back and tried to figure out exactly who this guy was, and generally that's not been too successful. There's some people who hold that that was a fairly common name. I've seen it argued on the other side of the fence as well, that that was not a very common name. But one idea that's probably, in my mind, one of the better conclusions is that he was likely one of the rebels who rose up after Herod the Great died in 4 BC. So that would have been around, you know, the time that Jesus was going to be coming into the world, roughly. And there's some confusion. Josephus talks about one fella by this name. Luke also talks about one fella. Some people have tried to join the two together. And if you do that, you find that there are, even though Luke doesn't give a lot of details, there are some details which don't match. And when you have critics of the Bible look at that information, they say, well, who must have been wrong? Luke, because Luke's, or the Bible writer, is always going to be the one that was the, in their mind, the default person as far as the one who made the error. But the one who Josephus described, he was described as a magician. I'll give you a quote here, who persuaded a great many people to gather all their possessions, follow him to the Jordan River. He was a self-proclaimed prophet. He boasted that he would command the Jordan to part as Elijah did Elisha. Well, that didn't work out very well. So I do think that there was a Thutis that is mentioned by Josephus. I don't think, though, that the two are the same, because there are some definite differences between the two. So we are going to let things stand as Luke describes them here. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little more? Ray?
When I read this passage, my first thought goes back to Absalom, when he gathered together a group of people to go against his own father's king.
Yeah.
And he didn't just go out and grab them real quick and form an army. He, out of the kindness of his heart, he friended them and brought them into the group. And I can see Thutis doing this here to 400 men. That's not hardly a big enough army to overcome the Romans, though, but it's certainly something that the Jews would be looking at. And why they was after him to kill him so quickly, they were not told. But to think that he might have been looked at as being the Christ, but we have no evidence of that one way or another. But the Jews might have been thinking that way.
Yeah, he makes some kind of big claim, some kind of boisterous claim. He thought he was somebody. You do find subversive movements. You find in almost any government that's big enough, there are going to be people who try to undermine it, people who try to raise up. Right now, if you look at our country, you have some people who are trying to put together a movement to say that President Trump is unfit. Now, maybe you believe that, maybe not. That's not relevant for today's discussion. I simply pointed out that you have a sitting president, and there's some people who say, we want to call you crazy, and we want to get rid of you because that is our particular view. So whether it's in a particular state or whether it is in a nation, you always have some people who are unhappy. Even I think in the best government, you're going to have some individuals who are not pleased as far as how certain things are going. Anything else that you want to add or ask before we move down and say a couple more items? Okay, Gamaliel, his argument as far as the basic point that he's making, history repeats itself, is one that we sometimes make as well. That argument is often true. When we talk about history being a good teacher or history repeats itself, oftentimes it is the case. But in this instance, that certainly was not true. When you look at it from just the standpoint of numbers, we're dealing with about how many folks of Thutis? He raised up about 400 men. But when you look at Christianity at this point, what do you have as far as people? Thousands and thousands and thousands. Remember the illustration I think I gave you a couple weeks ago? We were talking about the one cuppers, people who believe that you have to. I gave you that illustration, didn't I?
I don't think so.
You don't? Nobody remembers that? Okay, well, maybe it was just Gary. All right, a couple Sundays ago, I got home, and in my email box, there was a message from, did a little looking, and it was a message from a preacher in Oklahoma, and he said, I want to enlighten you, and we can have fellowship, yada, yada, yada. So did a little looking and figured out that he was a one-cup preacher from Oklahoma, and he was spreading his doctrine as far and wide as he could, and he decided to send some information to us. So within the last year, I had picked up some information from one of our older preachers. He's now probably in his 80s, good debater, sharp mind, very, very good as far as dealing with some crazy ideas. And this fella, in one of his debates with a one-cup preacher, pointed out that by the time you get to this period in Acts chapter 5, you probably have about 10,000 Christians. There is no indication that there is more than one congregation at this point. Now, maybe that was true, but there's no indication of that. So he did the math. He said, okay, this is about how much juice we have when we take communion, and I think that the size of the cup would be very similar to what we use. But he said, let's be generous to my opponent. So let's reduce the amount. And then we have 10,000 people roughly, and he did the math. And the container that he came up with was almost a 20-gallon container for the number of people. Now, can you imagine being a one-cupper, a 20-gallon container? Nobody's going to be able to heft that. And then he did the math as far as how long it would take for everybody to go up. I think he allotted 5 seconds, since you can't pass the container, being, you know, a 20-gallon container, how long it would take for everybody to get in there, almost like cattle. Being able to get into the one cup and everybody partake, and he gave each person 5 seconds. And that came down to, I'd have to go back and look at the exact math, but it came down to about 20 hours for everybody to get their communion juice. And his question in that debate was, when did they start worship? How long did they worship? Since it took them roughly 20 hours to do nothing but have the communion juice. So I tell you that's a little off topic, but that's free for today's class. You can take that home and just kind of keep that in mind. Maybe you'll need that at some point when you're having a discussion with somebody. But Gamaliel's argument is there are just a few hundred people over here, and that was shut down. But it's not parallel to history, because what's happening with the Christians, you've got thousands and thousands, and if you take the one-cup communion view, they're spending the better part of the day trying to get a drink on Sunday of the one-cup communion juice. So even though he was a bright man, from what we can tell, he really missed it on this point. Christianity had grown to the point where bunches and bunches of people were Christians. A couple of the quick items here, and then we'll look at Acts 5, verse 37. As you look at the word which is translated join, that word occurs 4 times in the New Testament. The other 3 places are Matthew 19, 5, Mark 10, verse 7, and Ephesians 5, verse 31. Now, those verses may not immediately sound familiar to you, but if you were to look at those other 3 passages, you would find that in many translations, they would be rendered cleave. Those are marriage verses. So you have these 400 of these, about 400 people. They join themselves. They cleave. That is the sense of marriage in those other 3 passages. Does that tell you a little bit about something about concerning people when they rise up and they are going to be part of a submersive movement? They cleave. to the group. They cleave to their leader. We would use, I think, a different word. We would say they are, well, I was thinking of a different word. That would be a great word. It starts with F. They are fanatics. Uh-huh. And you see that, I think, with that commitment there. And that word is, as I said, used to describe marriage in those other three passages. So that certainly is an appropriate word. So here we would say that the people rallied to his cause by following him. Another interesting word is that the people were slain. That word is also used in verse 33. If you back up just a few verses, the followers of Thutis had been slain, and the group Gamaliel was talking to. What did they want to do concerning the apostles? Well, or slay them. And that's exactly right. When you look at the dispersing that you are looking at here, and all as many as obeyed him were dispersed and came to naught, some have suggested that that was a divine act as far as God being involved with the disbursement, and that's possible. Gamaliel's warning the Sanhedrin to be careful about the treatment of the apostles. If God had the ability to disperse these fellows, get rid of them, then certainly he has the ability to do a similar thing with the followers of Christ. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at Acts 5:37? Okay, 5:37 says, after this man, moving forward in history a little bit, rose up Judas of Galilee in the days of the enrollment and drew away some of the people after him. He also perished, and all as many as obeyed him were scattered abroad. Gamaliel may have felt like one example was not enough to quiet the people, so now he turns to a second illustration, and this one involves Judas. Now, do you think this Judas is the one who betrayed the Lord? Judas the Apostle? No. You need to be very, very careful of that. Just because you have the same name, maybe the same name of someone who is living in the same community, it does not mean it is the same person. So this Judas lived in the days of the enrollment. That would take us back to about 6 AD, roughly. Enrollment is used only here in Luke chapter 2, verse 2. And when you look at that word here, it tells you something. In our time, do we, maybe not to the point that these people did, but do we mark time by events? Yeah, can you think of some examples? All right, that was the one that was going through my mind as well. 9/11, that just is a date in history that marks some things. When I give you this illustration too, I don't know what was the best thing. I shook my head and told Teresa about it, and she just said, well, that's the current generation. But I paid a credit card bill over the phone the other day. And the lady was pretty joyous. She said, wow, you've been a customer since 1993. I was only a year old in 1993. Well, you know, okay. I didn't really need to know that. But, you know, for her, 1993 was a big date because that was the year, that was the time when she had turned a year old. So you have events like this where people will mark time. I was this number of years old, or this is the year that I had surgery, or this is the year I got married, or there's some other marker. And when you look at how Luke uses this word, it was the time of the enrollment. That shows you, that tells you, that people mark time by events such as this. Now, we do things a little differently as far as a clock. We use a calendar, but people in ancient times operated by a slightly different method. Judas of Galilee, he formed a following a few years after Jesus was born. You also have some information. More likely, I think, we're dealing with the same guys. You go back to Josephus, and the information there, I'll give you a couple of quotes. He attracted people by saying that they should not pay tribute to Caesar. Now, on the face of it, do you think that got some attention? You guys shouldn't pay taxes to Rome. I think there were probably a few people who were receptive to that message. Soon after the dethronement of Archelaus, about the year AD 6 or 7, Emperor Augustus ordered a tax to be levied on the Jews. Well, that gets the attention of people. Anybody see that Indiana's going to have a 10-cent gas tax increase? All right, it happened yesterday, so Teresa told me it was coming. But people pay attention to that. Only a dime. And when you think about a fill-up, you know, 30 gallons, only going to be $3, but people will, hey, we've got a gas tax now beyond what we were paying before. So that gets the attention of people. All right, so he ordered this tax to be levied on the Jews. The payment of that tax, Judas instigated the people to resist on the ground of it being a violation of their allegiance to Jehovah to pay tribute to a foreign power. He took up arms in defense of this principle and organized a powerful opposition to the Roman government. Well, you can imagine how well that went over with Rome. You're going to oppose us for the tax. What's going to happen to you? squash. And that's pretty much what happened. But again, Gamaliel needs something to cool down the hotheads. So he reaches back into history, somewhat recent history, to say, look, once again, here was opposition. It did not work very well. And you fellas just need to bide your time. All this is going to blow over. Now, when you look at the people who followed Judas, they eventually disbanded. The word scattered is used in the ASV. If you have the King James translation, that word is probably going to be dispersed. Interestingly, that same word is applied to Jesus' disciples in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 31. Judas died, his followers, they're disbanded, and Gamaliel implies that the apostles, what's going to happen with them? They're also going to they're going to scatter, there's going to be a disbursement, they're going to fizzle out, their movement is going to last for a little while, and when they scatter, what's going to happen to the followers? They're also going to scatter, they're going to disband, so no reason to become really concerned about them, certainly no reason to kill them. So give it enough time, and it's also going to not continue. So we're going to be good. Let's just wait it out. Anything you might add or ask before we look at verses 38 and 39? Acts 5. Ray?
Just the ASV, they're called at the room at that time that they all together take the census.
Yes.
And the same thing with Jesus and as a baby was.
Yeah, back there in Luke chapter 2. So it was a big deal for a lot of reasons. The census, still a little different for us, but it's still a big deal, and also was a way to mark time. In our time, we'll say, well, that was 5 years ago, or that was 10 years ago, whatever it might be. But for these people, it was one of the things that really got the attention of people and stuck in the heads. Very good. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at what we have in verses 38 and 39. And now I say unto you, so he's bringing things to a head. Here comes the conclusion. Refrain from these men and let them alone. For if this counsel or this work be of men, it will be overthrown. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them, lest haply ye be found even to be fighting against God. Gamaliel may have offered more information, additional examples, we don't know. But Luke has given us at least two of the examples that he cited. Movements had been formed, movements had been collapsed, and as I said, here is the conclusion. Now you have this fella. As we talked about before, he's trained a lot of people. He's trained some very bright people. He is regarded as one of the better minds as far as the law and certainly the Jewish faith. So he wants people to sit back and wait. So there is some truth in what Gamaliel said, but he didn't hit all the points correctly. When you start looking at his argument, what's one of the things that he misses? If this is of God, what have the apostles been doing? Remember? Signs, miracles, wonders. Do you remember how we talked about the streets? How the people were coming from outlying areas? It wasn't in just Jerusalem, but they're coming from the outside areas. And what were they doing to the streets? Filling them up. You can just imagine the clogged streets and the signs, the miracles, the wonders that they were doing. So this isn't something that involves just a few people. This has extended outside the area of Jerusalem, all the miracles that were performed. But if you have people who are not really in a rational state of mind, sometimes just about any argument works, especially, I don't know if Gamaliel was a good speaker, but especially if he were an eloquent speaker, he gets up, maybe a commanding presence, gives a couple examples, and that's enough to cause the people to start rethinking things. We don't know when Gamaliel died, but I find it to be interesting to consider if this fella lived just a few more years, certainly 5 years or 10 years or 15, do you think he got to see how wrong his advice was? Yeah. But sometimes people are not really interested in a long-range plan. As long as it gets them through when? Yeah, that time, today. We'll deal with this week, the current problem, then we're okay. But he certainly, if he was willing to follow Christianity, came to realize it didn't die. I think Betty made the point a few weeks back. One wonders if Gamaliel was at some point exposed more to the faith by Paul. If he comes back and says, well, hey, look, I want to talk to you about the Christian faith. You were my teacher. You were my instructor. I'm now a teacher. I'm now a preacher of the gospel of Christ. Let's sit down and discuss this. And certainly if some additional time had gone by, Gamaliel sees that he's wrong. Maybe hears more about Paul. That's fascinating to consider. Gamaliel also, as you look at verse 30, going back there, mentions a second consideration. He says, if Christianity came from God, what would be true? All right, you can't fight it. You can't stop it. Now, as we mentioned, there is no proof that Gamaliel actually believed that Christianity had come from God. Rather, this seems to be the employment, the using of secular, worldly wisdom to once again get this crazy mob calmed down a little bit. So he does make this acknowledgement, but there's no indication that he really believes that. Trace? that's a good point. I mean, anytime you're standing up in front of a mob, there's always some danger. Even if you are highly regarded by the people, you can just be steamrolled over by the folks. So he probably does need to give some consideration to his standing and his well-being. So you see him kind of covering all the bases here and using argumentation, which will calm the people down. Though as you start looking at the details of what he said, you can begin to pick that apart little by little. So that's a really good point as well. Now the idea, he says, look, if Christianity is not of God, it's going to be overthrown. On the surface, that may sound good, but would you say that there are some flaws or problems with that line of reasoning? If it's not from God, it's going to fail.
Sometimes men do come up with ideas that stand for a while, at least.
Okay. Anybody want to take that and be a little more specific? Okay, men will come up with some ideas that at least stand for a certain period of time.
The United States.
Okay, sometimes it's a country.
Yeah, well,
it's a nation.
Our government's been over 200 years, but we don't know how much longer.
Sure. What about some moral issues? If this is not from God, what about the liquor industry? Not from God, but has it failed? No. What about pornography? Not from God, but has it failed? No, I mean, it just continues to explode. What about false religions? Some of them have been around for many, many centuries. So the idea, well, if it's not from God, it's going to flop. That's simply not true. But as Teresa said, if you are in the heat of the moment, you're arguing to quell, you're arguing to put this mob down, and you're also probably concerned a little bit for your safety, for your reputation, sometimes, you know, the finer points may be overlooked. Now, here's one thing that I find to be very, very interesting. If you were to talk to someone who is from a Roman Catholic background, and they know Catholic doctrine very well, you might find that they turn over to Acts chapter 5, verses 38 and 39, and say, this is proof, this is evidence that our church is from God. The Bible says the faith is not going to fail. And how long have we been around for? A long, long time. So that is proof from God that we are the right church. Now you might hear that, and say, "Wow, that just stuns me." But if you were talking with someone who was from a Catholic background, what would your answer be? How would you meet that argument? Well, okay, I think you could say that. Does it go back to what we find in the Book of Acts? The church was established. You know, being a long-term church is not the same as being the church that was founded by Christ and described in the New Testament. You could make that point. What else could you describe or say?
There are many other denominations that have been around for 400 or 500 years. So they've been around a long time, too. So they must be of God. Say the same thing back to the Catholics.
Well, Islam. You can go back to about 600 years after Christ and Muhammad starts to come on the scene about then. So that becomes a question. So we're not, as Carol was saying, we're not talking about an old one. We're talking about the first one. And we the first one. Anything else?
Catholics will go back to Jesus saying, Peter, upon this rock I will build a church. So they think it started then, not after Jesus died.
Yeah. Okay. They will make that argument. But again, let's dig into the Bible and see if that rock was Peter, or see if that rock was Christ.
Could, if you believe in that Jesus is the Christ, these were Jews talking, and they never, right? Gamaliel talking, he's a Jew. They don't believe that Christ is the Messiah, Jews to this day, right?
You're headed down the right road, Bonnie. I think we just need to straighten that line out a little bit. Who was talking? Who makes this argument? If it's of God, it's not going to fail.
He's a priest.
It's Gamaliel. All right, he is a Pharisee. Was Gamaliel an inspired man?
No.
So we have this fellow making this statement is the information that he says recorded in an inspired way. Yes. I mean, we have the right information that he said. However, just because inspiration recorded what he said does not mean that what he said is inspired. Stated another way, what do we mean?
Consider the source.
Yeah. I didn't look at it that way, but that's exactly right. Consider the source. It's like Job and his friends a little bit. You have some statements in the book of Job. Inspired information? Yes. But is it true? No. It's not true in the sense that God says, this is something that I put my stamp of approval on. It's only inspired in the sense that what these uninspired men said was accurately recorded. And that is a very important point. Even the devil, we have information from him, inspired as far as what he said, but not inspired like what Peter and Paul and Luke had to say. All right, there were a couple of hands I thought that started to come up and didn't stay up. Glenda?
Just an argument about the guys that have come before them and get used, you know. Well, other people, you know, even before the church began here, said that they were the Messiah and they were wrong. So what gives you the right for me to believe? Convince me through the word.
Sort of. Do you want to add a little more to that?
Well, he talked about if we're having a study with a Roman Catholic and they say they're there in
right.
the church, you can also use the argument here about Theus, or what's his name?
Theudas.
Theudas. And Judas, that said they were who they thought they were, and they were wrong as well.
Yeah. Yes. And again, you have inspired information in the sense that this was accurately recorded, but these guys were saying some things and it wasn't truthful. They didn't have it right as far as their conclusion, but it was sufficient to calm down the crowd. Is there somebody else over here? Betty or Ray? That Don.
But he wasn't claiming that Theodos and Judas were from a religious standpoint, but he was saying that they were secular. Judas against the census, and
Theodos,
maybe an insurrection or whatever.
Right.
So it was two different contexts. These apostles were basically from a religious standpoint that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God.
I see Gamaliel at this point putting on his politician's hat. He's offering his best dog and pony show. He offers two different examples, as you mentioned. One looks like it's coming from a religious perspective, that would be Theudas. Judas coming from a more secular perspective with the taxes and so forth. And, you know, maybe he's very polished. Maybe he's able to impress the people with his eloquence. Maybe his presence is sufficient to help calm things down a little bit. But he's going back into history, bringing these things out, maybe speaking in a very calm tone, just like you'd have a politician stands up and tries to make things right with the folks. Now, how much of that he was able to do, I don't know. But we do know the end result, that the group decided that they were not going to kill the apostles. They were going to beat them, charge them not to speak anymore in the name of Christ. But whatever he said, however he said it, and I say whatever he said, maybe beyond what we have here, was very, very successful. Because when you have people who are incensed, I mean, people who are ready to kill somebody, and they go from that all the way down to, well, okay, let's just beat them a little bit or some. And, they're apparently able to walk. So the beating was not to the point where they're lying on the floor and have to have somebody carry them off. So when you have people who are in that state and they're brought down to a more rational state, somebody has really done a good job. And it's not that he's just calmed down one or two. If the full Sanhedrin is there, he's got 70-plus people, and they're all seeing red. So when you look at his oratorical skills, whatever it was, he was very, very successful, even though his logic wasn't quite right.
You know, it almost makes you wonder if they were in that situation. He was a major person in the Pharisee. Why he even tried to calm them down? Why didn't he just go
That's a good question. Whether or not he was able to see that this was a situation that didn't merit death, or maybe he was looking at it longer term and thought, if we do this, then we've got more martyrs on our hands. Jesus was bad enough, and maybe he had the wisdom to see that going down this path would create more difficulties. We're not quite sure what was going through his head, but still, everything that we can tell about him, he was not persuaded that the gospel was right. So here,
they were still killing the Christians. Yeah. I mean, you know, they sent Paul out. I mean, they were still, so I mean, you know, what was the difference in this one time and going out and pursuing them later?
Well, and I think you have to put providence in here. That God ensured that the right man was in the right place at the right time, and he was able to use his background and circumstances from the past, including Thutis and Judas, to ensure that, yeah, it's a great example of providence in my mind as well. You know, he's using his free will, but ultimately that free will is not used to obey the gospel. So sometimes even if a person is not an enemy of the truth, they may be sort of neutral or somewhat friendly, and God can still use that to the benefit of his people. Trace?
How do you know that Judas isn't religious?
Well, I think when you look at the text, let's go back and see what we've got there.
What was the question?
How do we know that Judas was not religious? It says in verse 37, after this rose up Judas of Galilee in the days of the enrollment and drew away some of the people after him. He also perished. Let's see. Didn't we have some information in here about taxes?
So after the taxes,
day of taxing. I don't
think
we really know for sure.
If it came to Josephus.
Well, there was that.
It says it in, on in verse.
The day of the taxes.
Yeah, there was the information from Josephus.
Seven, it says days of taxing. Yours says days of enrollment. This
is enrollment. Okay, enrollment taxing. I think that would be a translation matter is as far as what they were looking at.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't because of the religious.
I mean, as a Luke 2,
that was during the census.
Joseph
and that was to get Jesus into Nazareth.
Yeah.
The Josephus account.
Yeah, I think the Josephus account, as I said, lines up with this one pretty well, so we seem to be fairly confident that it was the same guy. So, some from the scripture, more from Josephus.
Okay.
That it? Done?
But if Judas killed them, would that make them to the Romans?
We know from the book of John that the Jews didn't have that authority, but just because people don't have the authority, we both know that that doesn't mean that they're going to fail to act. So without, as we talked about with Betty's comment, without God's providence, their Gamaliel's intervention, I believe they would have been killed. Trying to stop the mob, I think under other circumstances, you know. Well, look at what happens with Stephen. I mean, there's no authority from the Romans to go after him, but the Bible says they gnashed on him with their teeth. They are just so upset. The rage is so great. You know, they stone him. And even with the Sanhedrin, those guys may not have moved as quickly as somebody in the early 20s. But yes, I do believe that they probably would have killed at least some of the apostles. Maybe they wouldn't have gotten them all. That raises some interesting questions. Had God not allowed Gamaliel to show up, the apostles are the ones who are going to, you know, take the gospel into the whole world. How does God intervene at that point? Does he perform a miracle from heaven just to stop these guys? Would it be like what you have with Lot? Are they blinded? There would have been a lot of things that God could have done, but in this case, it seems to me that he had a somewhat hands-off approach with Gamaliel. There was no need, as far as I can tell, to intervene with any kind of supernatural power. Gamaliel is used there to sufficiently stop these guys. And it really is, when you think about the miraculous acts of God in the book of Acts, it really is amazing that God was able to use this one fellow to bring these fellows into a more reasonable state. Yeah, eventually, well, it's not too long until we get to Acts chapter 8, verse 1, and then they are finally scattered. But it seems like they need to spend a little more time in Jerusalem to continue to preach and teach the gospel. And then, as I say, you've got the information in Acts chapter 6 about the widows that needs to be cared for and so forth. So it looks like they've got to hang around for a little while longer, and God works through Gamaliel to ensure that that takes place. Now, being God, he could have obviously gone on a number of other tracks had that been required and used more power. But he used the smallest amount of power, I guess we might say, to keep things headed in the right way. Anybody else? Okay, let's finish some things up while we've got just a little more time. I want to give you this quote. It talks about the continuation of Christianity for more than 2,000 years is remarkable. As one source said, Christianity has survived the assaults of paganism and even overthrown paganism wherever it spread. It has resisted the still more dangerous onsets of philosophy and science, and in large measure Christianized these. It stood up against the combinations of world empires and reduced these, in name at least, to subjection beneath the scepter of Christ. It has maintained its vitality and influence, notwithstanding the corruptions of its purity that have arisen within its own burdens and from the midst of its own adherents. It has met the deepest spiritual wants of the individual soul and of the world in a way that no other religion has done. It has extended its sway to almost every country under heaven. After 19 centuries, it evinces no sign of decay. Other religions are waxing old and vanishing away. It is, with the passing years, increasing in vigor and acceptance.